Chapter 5. Masculinity and Femininity in the Spiritual Life. To refer to masculinity and femininity in any context these days is, of course, to tread on dangerous ground. And perhaps even using quotation marks, as in the title, will not be sufficient to guard against the ever-present possibility of being taken too literally. As we shall see, though, it is in fact quite appropriate to use these terms to characterise the third and fourth paramitas to be practised by the Bodhisattva, Kshanti and Virya. Kshanti, to be distinguished from Shanti, which means peace, is one of the most beautiful words in the whole vocabulary of Buddhism. It links a number of associated meanings, so there is no one English word which can do it full justice. It literally means patience or forbearance, and it is the antidote to anger, as dana is to craving. As well as the absence of anger and the absence of the desire for revenge, Kshanti has overtones of love, compassion, tolerance, acceptance and receptivity. It also includes gentleness and docility, and there is even a suggestion in it of humility, though not in any artificial self-conscious sense. When Mahatma Gandhi founded one of his ashrams in India, he apparently drew up a long list of virtues to be practiced by the ashramites. It was a long list, and at the top he put humility. But someone pointed out that if you practice humility deliberately, self-consciously, it becomes not humility, but hypocrisy. So the Mahatma crossed out humility and wrote at the bottom of the list, all the virtues are to be practiced in a spirit of humility. A rather different thing. Here we will discuss three principal aspects of Kshanti: forbearance, tolerance, and spiritual receptivity. Each aspect will be introduced by a story, as a reminder that Kshanti is not something to be theorised or speculated about, but essentially something to be practised in our everyday life. Kshanti as forbearance is illustrated by a story from the life of the Buddha himself, a story found in the Sutra of 42 sections, which incidentally was the first Buddhist text to be translated into Chinese. The original version, we don't know whether it was in Pali or Sanskrit, no longer exists, but historically the sutra is of considerable importance. Anyway, apparently the Buddha was walking along one day when he happened to encounter somebody, probably a Brahmin, but we don't know, who for some reason wasn't very pleased with the Buddha, and immediately started to call him all sorts of names. This sort of thing often happens in the Pali scriptures. The Buddha was by no means universally popular in his own day. Some people resented the fact that he seemed to be enticing people away from their families and encouraging them to think of nirvana instead of thinking about making money. So the man stood there for a while, abusing the Buddha with all the offensive words in his vocabulary. But the Buddha didn't say anything. He just waited for the man to stop speaking. And eventually the man did dry up. Perhaps he ran out of breath. The Buddha quietly said, "Is that all?" Rather taken aback, the man said, "Yes, that's all." The Buddha then said, "Let me ask you a question. Suppose one day a friend brings you a present, but you don't want to accept it. If you don't accept it, to whom does it belong?" The man said, "Well, if I won't accept it, it belongs to the person who's trying to give it to me." So the Buddha said, "Well, you have tried to make me a present of your abuse, but I decline to accept it. Take it, it belongs to you." Of course, few of us would be capable of such a measured response. If someone verbally abuses us, we tend to come up with a stinging retort, or keep the insult burning in our mind and find a way of getting our own back later on. But it is possible to learn to respond differently. How? The great teacher Shantideva gives some hints. He says, for example, suppose someone comes along and beats you with a stick. That's a painful experience, but it doesn't justify your flying into a rage. Instead, you need to try to understand what has happened. If you analyse it, he says, it is simply that two things have come together, the stick and your body. And who is responsible for this coming together? The other person has admittedly taken the stick to you, so he is partly responsible. But you have provided the body. And where did that body come from? It came from your previous samskaras, your ignorance and the things that you did based on your ignorance in your previous lives. Why should you get angry with your enemy for bringing his stick and not with yourself for bringing your body? In his Bodhicharyavatara, Shantideva produces a number of reflections of this kind, designed to help us practice forbearance. Of course, it isn't just a question of practicing forbearance towards people who assail us with harsh words or sticks. In Buddhist literature, the contexts in which forbearance is to be practiced are classified into three groups. First of all, there is nature, the material universe which surrounds us, especially in the form of the weather. It is generally either too hot or too cold, or there's too much wind or too much rain or not enough sunshine. All these climatic changes demand a certain degree of forbearance. Then there are what are known in law as acts of God, natural disasters beyond human control, like fire and flood, earthquake and lightning. Occasionally, we may need to practice forbearance in the face of such events as these. Secondly, we need to be forbearing towards our own body, especially when it is sick or suffering. We shouldn't get angry with the body and all its aches and pains. We shouldn't start beating brother ass, as St. Francis would say. After all, we have brought the body here. It is our responsibility. While we should always try to alleviate suffering, whether our own or that of other people, as best we can, we need to realise that there is a residue which cannot be relieved and must simply be borne with patience. Even if we did stay well, sooner or later, old age and death will come. In the modern West, many people refuse to grow old gracefully, with sometimes quite tragic consequences. In the East, and perhaps in traditional societies generally, by contrast, people often look forward to old age, and indeed tend to see it as the happiest time of life. All the passions and emotional turbulence of youth have subsided. One has gained experience, and with experience, perhaps just a little wisdom. And having handed everything over to the younger generation, one has fewer responsibilities and plenty of time for reflection, even meditation. Death is another matter, though. For most people, everywhere, it is a sobering consideration. But whether we like it or not, death will come, and we are well advised to practice forbearance towards the idea. Thirdly, one should practice forbearance towards other people. This, of course, is far more difficult than being forbearing towards the weather or even one's own aches and pains. Other people can be very difficult indeed. As a character in Jean-Paul Sartre's play, Huis Clos, famously put it, "Hell is other people." One might add that heaven is other people too, but that's another story. In Buddhist literature, and even in Buddhist life, the lofty ideal of forbearance is sometimes carried to impressive extremes. For instance, there is the parable of the saw. The Buddha one day called all his disciples together and said, "Monks, Suppose you were going through the forest one day, and you were seized by highwaymen. And suppose they took a sharp, two-handed saw, and sawed you limb from limb. If in your mind there arose the least thought of ill will, you would not be my disciple. This, then, is the sort of extreme to which this ideal can, and as an ultimate aim, should be carried. It isn't just a question of gritting your teeth and bearing it while feeling angry and resentful inside. The Buddha's teaching makes it clear that forbearance is essentially a positive mental attitude, an attitude of love. Having told the parable of the saw, the Buddha goes on to say, "Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. When men speak evil of you, thus must you train yourselves. Our hearts shall be unwavering. No evil word will we send forth, but compassionate of others' welfare will we abide, of kindly heart without resentment." And that man who thus speaks, will we suffuse with thoughts accompanied by love and so abide? And making that our standpoint, we will suffuse the whole world with loving thoughts, far-reaching, wide-spreading, boundless, free from hate, free from ill will, and so abide. Thus must you train yourselves. The most succinct expression of this kind of forbearance is to be found in the Dhammapada, which says, "Forbearance is the greatest asceticism." The word being translated as asceticism is tapo, which generally refers to penance, austerities, practices of self-mortification. There were lots of these in ancient India. People would fast for months on end, or reduce their food to a few grains of rice a day, or every other day, or once a week. They would hang head downwards from a tree and meditate like that, or stand with one hand in the air and keep it there for months until it withered away. Then there was a famous practice called the Pancha Agni Tapasya, the asceticism of the five fires. To do this, you kindle fires at the four cardinal points, and when they were blazing hot, you sat in between them with the sun, the fifth fire, directly overhead. There are references to all these kinds of self-mortification in the Pali scriptures. They were enormously popular in the Buddha's day. Many people regarded them as a means to salvation, believing that the more the flesh was mortified, the finer, purer, more subtle, and more enlightened the spirit became. But the Buddha didn't agree, and he was speaking from experience. He had tried it all for 6 years unremittingly, and he had found that it didn't work. In fact, he came to see that, as he is quoted in saying in the Dhammapada, "It is patience, forbearance, which is the greatest tapo, the greatest asceticism." If you want to practice asceticism, there is no need to seek out special opportunities. There is no need to sit between five fires. Just live in the middle of everyday life. That will give you opportunities enough for the practice of forbearance. If you bear the trials and difficulties of life well, you are practicing the best and most difficult possible kind of asceticism. The Greek term askein was a very positive term, which meant to train. It is unfortunate that in English the original meaning has been lost, because we do perhaps need a word with a religious or spiritual connotation, which is expressive of that particular concept. Thinking of asceticism as training, everything we do as Buddhists is asceticism. It is not asceticism in the negative sense of the term, to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to meditate. It is simply a training. In the same way, silence is a training, ethics is a training, everything is a training. But whether it is appropriate to use the word asceticism to refer to that training is perhaps questionable. These days it brings to mind hair shirts, not athletic prowess. It seems strange that it should be so difficult to undo the meaning that words acquire, but it's as though one can't undo history. For many people, the word discipline has similar negative connotations. Again, the word can be used positively. For example, one speaks of a discipline in the sense of a particular branch of study. But another meaning of the word discipline is the whip that the Christian monk uses to chastise himself. So although one can live a disciplined life, in a very positive sense, as a Buddhist, not everyone will respond positively to the idea of the Buddhist life as being a life of discipline. Indeed, some people are going to prefer to lead a chaotic, spontaneous kind of Buddhist life. The second aspect of Kshanti is tolerance. This can be illustrated by a story from Buddhist history. In the 13th century, the Mongols were converted to Buddhism by a great Tibetan spiritual master called Pagpa, who was the head at that time of the Shakya school, one of the four great schools of Tibetan Buddhism. A man of great influence, ability and prestige, he was the spiritual teacher of the great emperor of China and Mongolia, Kublai Khan. In gratitude to Pagpa for his teaching, Kublai Khan gave him secular jurisdiction over the whole of Tibet. Indeed, such was his enthusiasm that Kublai Khan wanted to pass a law throughout his domains compelling all Buddhists to follow the Shakya teaching. One might think that Pagpa would have been pleased about that, but not at all. In fact, he dissuaded Kublai Khan from passing that law, saying that everybody should be free to follow the form of Buddhism they liked best. Such, he said, is the ancient Buddhist tradition. This tolerant attitude is typical of Tibetan Buddhists to this day. In fact, it has been the attitude of Buddhists everywhere at all times. The exceptions have been very few indeed. Perhaps a handful of serious but small-scale instances of Buddhist intolerance. This is in striking contrast to the history of the Christian Church, which, especially during the Middle Ages, involved so many instances of intolerance, fanaticism, and persecution that these things seem to have been the rule, not the exception. One has only to think of the ruthless destruction of the pagan culture of Western Europe, the wholesale massacre of heretics like the Cathars, the Albigenses, and the Waldenses, the sad and sorry story of the Inquisition and the Crusades, the witch burnings later on. All these things represented the official policy of the whole body of the Church, and everybody from the Pope downwards was involved, even some of those who were considered to be saints. One gets the impression of something almost pathological about this version of Christian history. Some people say that all this doesn't represent real Christianity. Perhaps so, but it has to be said that there are strong traces of intolerance in the Gospels themselves. The evidence suggests that Christianity had a tendency towards intolerance from the beginning, and has continued to be intolerant in many quarters right down to the present day. The only difference nowadays would seem to lie in the fact that Christian churches no longer wield sufficient power to be able to harm those who disagree with them. It would seem that intolerance, exclusiveness, and a tendency towards persecution and fanaticism are characteristic of all forms of monotheism. If one attempted to teach Buddhism in a Muslim country even today, one would probably pay dearly for it. But Buddhism is non-theistic. It doesn't teach belief in a personal God, a supreme being. Nor does it hold that religion consists in submission to or faith in such a supreme being. According to Buddhist teaching, every individual is responsible for his or her own spiritual destiny, and you can't be responsible without freedom to choose the form in which you follow that destiny. This is why there are so many different forms of Buddhism. Generally speaking, they are not sects or rival bodies claiming exclusive possession of Buddhist truths. They all represent particular aspects of the one total tradition. Although Buddhism teaches tolerance, not only towards all forms of Buddhism, but towards all other religions, it isn't vague. Its tolerance is not the woolly kind that simply blurs distinctions. Buddhist tolerance is not pseudo-universalist. But while it is clear about the truth of things, it does not impose its truth teachings on others. It is perhaps tempting to think that the more confident one is in the truth of what one believes, the more right one has to impose one's views on other people, and the greater their stupidity if they won't accept what one says. But Buddhist faith does not work like this. Buddhists should have a clear understanding of such precise, well-thought-out teachings as the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, conditioned co-production, shunyata, and so on. But perfect freedom is extended to other people to think differently. Buddhists don't, or shouldn't, become upset or feel threatened or undermined at the thought that elsewhere in the world, even in their own environment, there are people who don't accept what they accept, who don't believe that the Buddha was enlightened, who don't believe that the Noble Eightfold Path leads one to nirvana, who reject all that. At the same time, it is important that Buddhists should state their views clearly, and this in itself may seem to present a challenge or even a threat. One doesn't want to attack anyone's beliefs for the sake of it, but teaching the Dharma traditionally has two aspects: propagating the truth and dispelling error. And sometimes the two are closely connected. You can't express a non-theistic point of view without rejecting, and giving reasons for rejecting, belief in a personal God. Of course, that will be taken by some people as an attack on the notion of God, or on God himself. Buddhists in the West are sometimes afraid, or at least reluctant, to emphasize points of difference. One can't help feeling disappointed when Buddhist teachers prevaricate on the question of God. They know perfectly well that Buddhism is a non-theistic teaching, that belief in an Ishvara, a creator god, is rejected in all the Buddhist sources. But perhaps out of a concern to make some sort of common cause with Christianity, they sometimes not only play down the non-theistic character of Buddhism, but even let it appear that Buddhism is not, in fact, non-theistic. That is very unfortunate. To insist on this point may create antagonism, but as a Buddhist, one has to take that risk. We must be completely honest about what we believe. Otherwise, what is our so-called freedom of speech worth? We don't have to be aggressive or provocative. We can say what we have to say in a reasonable and positive and friendly way. One should never indulge in purely negative, destructive criticism. But one shouldn't prevaricate or conceal one's views. It is difficult for people with a Christian background to understand the nature of Buddhism. It is difficult to overcome one's tendency to see things in a particular way, and one needs to make a very definite effort to do so. In 1840, Carlyle wrote that at the time he was writing, it was difficult for people to understand or imagine the seriousness with which people in the 17th century took the Christian religion, and the conviction with which they believed that God was personally intervening in national politics, military campaigns, and so on. It would have been very difficult for a person of the 17th century in England to imagine a social order that was not solidly based on the rock of the Word of God. They honestly believed, if they considered it at all, that if people ceased to believe in God, or the Trinity, or the Incarnation, society would immediately fall apart. Christians approaching Buddhism are in a similar position. Even if they make a sincere attempt to understand it, they are likely still to be operating with their own assumptions and concepts, and trying to accommodate Buddhism within those. For instance, there's the hoary old chestnut of how it is that Buddhists who do not believe in God can worship the Buddha. People think they'll have you wriggling on a pin trying to explain this awful contradiction in your religion. When you lay out the reasoning step by step, the explanation is usually quite clear to them. But it represents a point of view that they had simply been unable to conceive of before. It works the other way round too. There are Buddhists in Thailand who find it impossible to understand how any sensible human being could believe in a God who created the world. The idea makes them fall about laughing. They don't even have a word in their language for God, and it takes Christian missionaries a great deal of time and trouble to explain to them the weird notion of a personal God who has made the heavens and earth. We have to try always to transcend the limitations of our own point of view, and at least try to imagine the possibility that someone believes something we don't. We can still reject it, but at least we won't find it incredible that someone should believe in that particular idea. While the kind of tolerance of religious diversity, which allows everyone the freedom to choose which spiritual path to follow, is clearly crucial, it is equally important to speak out against views that are spiritually harmful, wrong views, as the Buddha called them. The Pali term is micchaditti. A wrong view that needs to be addressed these days, perhaps rather more urgently even than the belief in a personal God, is one that is often linked and sometimes confused with tolerance. Pseudo-egalitarianism. One way of thinking about pseudo-egalitarianism is that it is the denial of the superior achievements of certain individuals and even groups. True egalitarianism is the faith that all beings everywhere have an infinite capacity to develop as individuals and to cultivate particular positive qualities of their own humanity to an infinite degree. Pseudo-egalitarianism is the unthinking assumption that everybody is quite literally equal and to be treated accordingly. This has become more or less a form of orthodoxy, neo-orthodoxy, one could say. In the Middle Ages and even later, it was considered unthinkable to question such doctrines as the divinity of Christ and the Trinity of the Godhead. So far as most people were concerned, if you did question them, you were so clearly flying in the face of an obvious truth that you must be either utterly stupid or inconceivably wicked. All decent, right-thinking people would automatically react against you. They might even want to imprison you or burn you at the stake. There was no question of sitting down and talking with you about it. You were so obviously just plain wrong. This is orthodoxy, the belief that somebody is so obviously wrong that they cannot be reasoned with, but only disposed of. And what I am calling neo-orthodoxy is like that too. Not a belief in this or that particular doctrine, but the attitude that if someone holds a certain view, there is no point in entering into discussion with them. In fact, it is almost impossible nowadays to say what one thinks, even in our Western democracies. We don't have freedom of speech. In practice, there are certain politically correct things that one is allowed to say, and certain things that one is not. How does a tolerant belief, or teaching, or organisation protect itself from an intolerant one? This is an extremely difficult question. Usually, people who believe in tolerance also believe in non-violence. There is no question of defending oneself by violent means. So what can one do? Is one to allow oneself to be completely overwhelmed? The only answer that presents itself, and it may not be a complete one, is that one must be far-sighted, diplomatic, even cunning. One must see the danger coming and take steps to counteract it before it reaches a point where only violent means would be effective. One must not hesitate to take full advantage of the law when it is on one's own side, and one must engage freely and vigorously in debate, presenting and arguing one's point of view, not letting one's case go by default. It is particularly important to protest against any misrepresentation of the Dharma. The Buddha himself corrected misunderstandings of his teachings. There's no doubt about that. And one can make such protests without becoming irate or hysterical. The third aspect of Kshanti I want to draw out here is spiritual receptivity. This time, our illustration comes from Chapter 2 of the White Lotus Sutra, Sadama Pundarika. This chapter opens with the Buddha sitting surrounded by his disciples, arahants, bodhisattvas, and so on, hundreds and thousands of them. The Buddha is seated cross-legged in the midst of the assembly, with his eyes half closed and his hands folded on his lap, immersed in profound meditation. He sits there for a long, long time. Being arahants, bodhisattvas, and other highly developed beings, those in the assembly don't start fidgeting and coughing. They just sit there with him quietly until eventually he emerges from his meditation. And when he does so, he makes an announcement. He says that the ultimate truth is very difficult to perceive. Even if he tried to explain it, he says, nobody would understand. It is so profound and vast, it so transcends all human capacity, that no one would be able to fathom it. Naturally, his disciples entreat him at least to try to communicate this truth to them, and eventually the Buddha agrees. He says that he will now proclaim to them a teaching that is further, higher, deeper than anything they have heard before. A teaching that will make their previous understanding seem childish. But when he says this, a whole group of the gathered disciples, the text says 5,000, start murmuring among themselves. Something further, something higher, something we haven't understood, something we haven't realised, impossible. And they just all walk out, all 5,000 of them. Their action is motivated by a natural human tendency that can be especially strong in those trying to lead a spiritual life. The tendency is to think that one has nothing more to learn, that one has sorted everything out. Of course, we are not complete fools. We'll say, oh yes, I've got a lot more to learn, I know I don't know everything. But we don't mean it, we don't feel it. We don't really connect with what such a statement implies. That we might actually need to change the way we think and behave. Learning something new might involve changing our whole attitude. It isn't just a question of acquiring additional information. It doesn't mean that having learnt all about the Majjhimaka school, one should be open-minded about further historical developments and the arising of sub-schools. Receptivity means being prepared for a radical change in one's whole mode of being. One's whole way of life, one's whole way of looking at things. And it's this we resist. It's this we protect ourselves against. The Mahayana teaches an aspect of Kshanti called the Anuttapattika Dharma Kshanti. The acquiescence in the truth that all phenomena are in reality illusory, non-existent, unproduced and undifferentiated. The general sense of this is that there are certain teachings or realizations which, when one comes into contact with them for the first time, one finds deeply disturbing. They shake one's whole being to the very core, to the extent that one finds it very difficult to accept them. The Anuttapattika Dharma Kshanti consists essentially in the attitude of not offering any resistance to these higher truths, when one encounters or experiences them. The particular higher truth referred to here is the truth that dharmas, the most irreducible elements of existence, do not in reality come into existence. Earlier Buddhist tradition spoke of dharmas as arising, persisting momentarily, and then ceasing. But the Mahayana teaching maintains that however minutely we may analyze our experience, the dharmas into which we analyze it cannot be said to represent actual separable entities. Thus, dharmas do not even come into existence. The bodhisattva is able to accept this teaching without resistance. And this sort of receptivity is referred to as a kind of kshanti. This non-resistance is clearly very difficult to achieve. Indeed, it is a characteristic of the irreversible bodhisattva. A bodhisattva who has reached a very advanced stage of the path indeed. What this irreversibility amounts to, we shall see in chapter 7. The natural tendency is to think that anything one doesn't understand must be nonsense and should be rejected without further thought. Kshanti clearly involves a lack of that kind of pride, an intellectual humility, the recognition that you don't know everything, in fact that you don't know anything at all. With that sort of attitude, you are much more likely to be open to new experience or knowledge. All of this is implied in the term kshanti. Spiritual receptivity is of the utmost importance. Without it, spiritual progress simply cannot be maintained. We need to hold ourselves open to the truth, as the flower holds itself open to the sun. This is what spiritual receptivity means, holding ourselves open to the higher spiritual influences that are streaming through the universe, but with which we are not usually in contact, because we usually shut ourselves off from them. We should be ready, if necessary, to give up whatever we've learnt so far, which isn't easy by any means, and to give up whatever we have become so far, which is still more difficult. How does one become spiritually receptive in this way? For a start, one can pray. As a Buddhist, one needs not to be too scared of the idea of prayer. It doesn't necessarily have theistic connotations. When a Tibetan Buddhist engages in an activity he calls prayer, he is not praying to God in the sense of the creator of heaven and earth, because such a conception is not part of the Tibetan Buddhist system of belief. He is praying to the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, or the Dakinis. Prayer, in its proper sense anyway, is not for material things, but for blessings, higher understanding, wisdom, compassion. One's prayers simply express the fact that one doesn't have those qualities and would like to have them. If you want something in an ordinary sense, you just say to someone, "Please pass me the toast. Please give me some money," or whatever it may be. In the case of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they have got wisdom and compassion, which you haven't got, but would like to have. So your aspiration to develop wisdom and compassion takes the form of a request to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to give you those qualities. As an informed Buddhist, you know very well that wisdom and compassion cannot be handed over like a slice of toast. But nonetheless, you continue to use the language of petition. Why? The reason is that the nature of language almost compels us to think of wisdom and compassion as qualities that can be acquired or received. If we use the language of prayer, we do so because it has a certain emotive value and expresses an openness and receptivity. It certainly doesn't reflect a literal belief that one can be given those qualities by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. In any case, one understands that those Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not really separate from oneself. They can be regarded as symbolizing unrealized states of one's own being that one is trying to activate through prayer. Prayer, understood in this way, is not out of place in Buddhism. It is very different from meditation. And it isn't that one is thinking, "I'll make a pretense of asking, but I know that I've really got to do it myself." When one is praying, one really feels that one hasn't got what one desires and that one must therefore ask for it. One may have an intellectual understanding, that it is all within oneself, but that is not one's experience when one is praying. If one experiences the desire to pray, there is no need to stop oneself on the strength of a purely rational understanding that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not really out there. Quite a few people over the years have told me that sometimes they feel like praying to the Buddha or to Bodhisattvas, but they tend to consciously inhibit the impulse, thinking that it is a weakness and not very Buddhistic to imagine the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas can give one anything. Surely, they say, any truly spiritual goal can be achieved only by one's own efforts. My reply is always that if one feels like praying, one should go ahead and do it, and work out the theology later. If it is a genuine feeling, don't suppress it. At the very least, prayer is a means of concentrating one's emotional energies. And in any case, it is as true to say that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are outside oneself as that they are within. Either way, one is still operating within the subject-object duality. It is no more valid to think of them as existing in the depths of one's own being than to think of them as existing beyond anything one can experience or conceive of. Both are equally real or equally unreal. Whether one thinks of that reality, which is neither subject nor object, as a sort of super-object outside oneself, or a super-subject within oneself, doesn't make any difference. The experience of many poets is rather like this. Poetic inspiration can be experienced as welling up from within, or as coming in from outside. Some poets genuinely experience being visited by the muses, so to speak. But whether poetic inspiration is called up from within or called down from above amounts to the same thing. Language has severe limitations here. One is trying to introduce into one's experience within the subject-object duality something which is beyond it, and which can be thought of either as emerging from within the depths of one's own being, or as something transcendentally aloof towards which one must direct one's prayers and aspirations. There are a number of differences between this and Christian prayer. Firstly, Buddhists do not postulate the Buddha, even conceived of as a Buddha to whom one can pray, as exercising any sort of cosmic function as creator, preserver, and so on. Also, for Christians, the God to whom they pray is genuinely an object, part of the objective universe, so to speak. But for the Buddhist, the Buddha, though experienced as an object, is in reality only a symbolic object, even a pseudo-object. At present, our experience is entirely within the subject-object framework, and the minute we think of that which is beyond that framework, we make it an object. If we postulate an object, that is the Buddha, to symbolize that which is neither subject nor object, then this Buddha object is an object only in a purely formal and symbolic sense, whereas the God of Christian theology is an object in a real sense. If you pray to God, you are a real subject praying to a real object. But if you pray to the Buddha, you are a symbolic subject praying to a symbolic object, so as to transcend the subject-object duality altogether. That is the difference. But as I said, we can leave aside all the metaphysics. If one wants to pray as an expression of Kshanti, of spiritual receptivity, one can simply do it. To balance Kshanti in all its forms, we need virya. The word presents us with no difficulties. It means potency, driving force, energy, vigour. It comes from the same Indo-Aryan root as the English word virility and also virtue, which originally meant strength. In specific Buddhist terms, as defined by Shantideva, virya is energy in pursuit of the good. Good here meaning enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. So virya doesn't mean just ordinary activity. If one is rushing here and there all day long, doing this and that, being busy, getting through a lot of work, one is not necessarily practicing virya. In his Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Gampopa defines laziness as being constantly active in subduing enemies and hoarding money. If we take subduing enemies as representing politics and hoarding money as representing business, Gampopa is saying that to engage, however energetically, in either politics or business is simply laziness, however apparently busy one may be. In a sense, all the other paramitas depend upon virya. To give, one needs a certain amount of energy. To practice the precepts, one needs energy. To meditate, one needs energy. Even to practice patience and forbearance, one needs energy, at least in the form of resistance to one's own negative impulses. To develop wisdom, one needs a deeper concentration of energy than is needed for anything else. So this particular paramita is crucially important, and it confronts us with perhaps the main problem of the spiritual life. The problem is this. We have, let us say, a spiritual ideal, an ideal of a state or an experience or a goal that we want to reach. Let us say that our spiritual ideal is the Bodhisattva ideal itself, and that we have a clear intellectual understanding of this ideal. We have read or heard about it, we have understood it, we could give a connected account of it if anybody asked us. But despite our clear intellectual understanding of the ideal, and our genuine acceptance of it, somehow we don't manage to attain it. The months, the years, even the decades go by, and although we have still got this ideal, we don't seem to have made any perceptible progress towards it. Indeed, we feel as though we're just where we started. Why is this? We are clear about the ideal. We know what we have to do. We even make an effort. Well, an intermittent effort, every now and then, for an hour or two. But nothing seems to happen. It's as though one were to stand at the foot of Mount Kanchenjunga and look up at the snowy peak, and then 20 years later, one were to find oneself at more or less the same spot. Why do we make no definite progress? The answer is almost certainly that we don't have enough virya. But why should this be? Why should we have no energy, no drive for the living of the spiritual life, for the realization of the ideal? After all, far from being short of energy, we are embodiments of energy, crystallizations of psychophysical, even spiritual energy. Our whole body, our whole mind is made up of energy. We are energy. The reason is usually that our energy is dissipated. Like a stream that is broken up into thousands of channels so that it loses its force, our energy flows out over innumerable objects, divided in numberless directions. Only a little of it goes into the spiritual life. The rest goes into all sorts of things that work against spiritual life, and we can end up feeling pulled apart and exhausted. Thus, the real problem, the central problem even of the spiritual life, is how to conserve and unify our energies. And to do this, we have to understand the way in which our energies are at present being dissipated. Generally, one may say, either they are blocked, or they leak away and are wasted, or they are simply too coarse and unrefined. One's energies may be blocked for various reasons. Perhaps one has been brought up to repress one's emotions, not to show or express them. It may be that one spends a lot of one's time engaged in routine work, into which one can't put one's energy. One's energy may be blocked simply because one has no positive creative outlet for it. Sometimes emotional energies are blocked on account of frustrations, disappointments, or fear of being hurt, or on account of unhelpful conditioning or education. especially of a heavy-handed religious kind. In all these ways, our energies congeal, harden, petrify within us. Above all, perhaps, energy is blocked by the absence of meaningful communication. Real communication has an energizing, almost electrifying effect. It really seems as if two people can spark each other off. Emotional energies are also just wasted, just allowed to leak away. This happens in all sorts of ways, but especially through indulgence in negative emotions. Negativity, fear, hatred, anger, ill will, antagonism, jealousy, self-pity, guilt, remorse, anxiety, wastes energy at a catastrophic rate. This is not usually just an occasional indulgence of ours. One needs only cast one's mind back over the last 24 hours to see how often one has given way to these mental states, and it all means the hemorrhaging of energy. Then there are the verbal expressions of these negative emotions, grumbling, carping criticism, fault-finding, doom and gloom-mongering, discouraging others, gossip and nagging. Through all these channels, energy drains away and becomes unavailable for spiritual purposes. Thirdly, emotional energy is not available for the living of the spiritual life because it is too coarse. Spiritual life requires spiritual energy. We can't meditate with our muscles. We can't meditate with our muscles, however strong and powerful they are. Meditation requires something more refined. Our energy, even our emotional energy, may be unavailable for the spiritual life because it is simply too coarse-grained. There are various ways of unblocking, conserving, and refining our energy. Blocks can be dissolved through cultivating awareness, particularly of one's own mental states, engaging in genuinely creative or at least productive work, and intensifying communication. And of course, some blockages get resolved spontaneously in the course of meditation practice. To stop wasting energy, one begins by becoming aware that one is indulging in negative emotions, and then trying to cultivate the opposite emotion. Love instead of hate, confidence instead of fear, and so on. As for verbal expressions of negative emotions, these just have to be stopped by an act of will. There's nothing else that one can do about them, and they don't deserve any better treatment. Another way of conserving energy is to introduce more silence into one's life. An enormous amount of our energy goes into talking. If one is silent for a while, a few minutes, a few hours, perhaps even a day spent quietly at home by oneself, energy accumulates within one in a wonderful way, and one feels calm, peaceful, aware, mindful. It's as though a clear, fresh spring of energy bubbles up inside, pure and untouched, because it is contained within oneself, not expressed outwardly in any way. The coarser emotional energies can be refined through practices that develop faith and devotion, like the Sevenfold Puja, and through the fine arts, music, painting, poetry, and so on. Some Buddhists maintain that the arts constitute a refined distraction from spiritual practice, but this is to miss the point. One's emotional energies have to be refined and focused if they are to be available for the spiritual life, for the practice of all the perfections, which the Bodhisattva must practice in order to attain Buddhahood. When his or her energies are all flowing in this one direction, no longer divided, the Bodhisattva becomes the embodiment of energy. At the same time, there is no hurry, no fuss, no restless busyness, just a continuous, seamless activity for the benefit of all sentient beings. Shantideva says that the Bodhisattva is like an elephant, a highly complimentary comparison in the Indian literary tradition, by the way. The elephant, especially the male elephant, is a playful beast, and he loves to bathe in lotus ponds. He merrily squirts water over himself and trumpets, and plucks great bunches of lotus flowers, washes them carefully, and eats them. In this way he passes the day very happily. As soon as he has finished playing in one pond, he plunges into another, and the Bodhisattva is like that. As soon as one task is finished, he dives straight into another with equal delight. So if one is a Bodhisattva, one doesn't think that one is doing anything very special. One doesn't think, well, here I am, working for the benefit of all sentient beings. One's manifestation of energy is selfless, a spontaneous bubbling up like a fountain, an uncontrived blossoming like a flower unfolding. Sometimes the Bodhisattva's activity is spoken of as a lila, a sport, a sort of game that the Bodhisattva plays. This is how he or she experiences the manifestation of the perfections, the different aspects of the path to enlightenment, and eventually the great game of Buddhahood, the manifestation of enlightenment itself. The word lila is used more commonly in Hinduism than in Buddhism, but it is found in some Buddhist texts. Furthermore, the term lalita, which like lila can mean play, occurs in the title of a Mahayana biography of the Buddha called the Lalita Vistara, a compound word which might be translated as the extended account of the play of the Buddha. The Mahayana, broadly speaking, taught what might almost be described as a docetic Buddhology. Docetism was the belief which arose in early Christianity that the body of Jesus was only apparent, from the Greek dokeo, appear, seem, not real. This doctrine, which was especially prevalent among 2nd century Gnostics, stressed the divinity of Christ and denied any physical suffering on his part. The Mahayana version of this arose from its teaching that the Bodhisattva career extended over 3 asamkhayas of kalpas. According to tradition, the Buddha-to-be spent the life before the one in which he gained enlightenment in a god realm called the Tusita Devaloka. We can imagine that after all those lifetimes of spiritual practice, by the time the Bodhisattva arrives in the Tusita Devaloka and is waiting there to be reborn as the son of Suddhodana and Mayadevi, he is a very advanced being indeed. From our point of view, he is probably indistinguishable from a Buddha. And he is not at that time under the power of karma. So, this is where the docetism comes in. It is almost as though he emanates from himself a ray that descends into the womb of Mayadevi and is eventually, to all appearances, reborn. He does not lose his virtually enlightened consciousness in the process. It requires just a few virtually effortless steps for him to attain supreme perfect enlightenment. Looking at it in this way, all the events of the Buddha's life could be said to happen not in reality, but as a sort of play. He doesn't need to learn anything. He just plays at learning. He doesn't need to get married. He doesn't need to have a son. And he doesn't really have a son, according to the Mahayana. Indeed, according to at least some Mahayana sutras, the Buddha's son, Rahula, was himself an emanation from a higher world. In the same way, Siddhartha's leaving home was a play. His studying with various teachers was a play. According to some Mahayana sutras, even the gaining of enlightenment itself was a play, because in a sense he had already gained it. At whatever level of transcendental attainment, the Bodhisattva just plays. One can regard this as a spontaneous overflowing of his or her inner realization, which transcends the immediate situation. He or she appears to participate in the immediate situation But really, it isn't so. It's all a lila. Play here is the apparent participation of a more highly developed being in a lower level of functioning, without being limited by it in the way an ordinary person would be. This teaching is quite prominent in some aspects of the Mahayana, though it doesn't feature at all in the Theravada. The Bodhisattva takes things very lightly, in a sense. It has been said that to worldly people, spiritual people appear frivolous because they don't care about the things that matter to worldly people. If you are spiritually minded and you lose something, or you are not given something you're expecting, you tend to take it quite lightly, whereas a more worldly-minded person would take it very seriously indeed. In the same way, the spiritually-minded person regards as a joke things that worldly people don't find funny at all, because he or she has a greater sense of proportion. It has been said that one of the elements of humour is a sense of proportion, a sense of relative fitness. For instance, one might see a politician delivering a speech so pompously and with such self-importance that one can't help laughing, because one can see that he is not as important as he thinks he is, or as he is trying to appear. According to the Pali Canon, the Buddha did say on one occasion that to laugh in such a way as to show the teeth is to be mad. But perhaps one shouldn't take this too literally. Perhaps he was thinking of uncontrollable laughter, just abandoning oneself to it, throwing oneself around, and laughing in a raucous, crude, unmindful way. The Buddha himself is almost always represented with a gentle smile, and even the Abhidharma, and you can't get much more austere than that, lists the smile of the Arhant among its classifications. So the Abhidharma itself has a place for something like lila, something spontaneous just for its own sake. For the smile of the Arhant is said to be without karmic significance. Perhaps the Buddha's smile arises from his perception of the incongruity between the conditioned and the unconditioned. Or perhaps he smiles a little at the mess unenlightened beings get themselves into, though at the same time he responds to them with deep compassion. Does a sense of humour have a part to play in the life of a Buddhist? Here one has to be very careful. Humour is often negative and sometimes cruel, even sadistic or cynical. Cynicism can represent a fear of positive emotion, including one's own positive emotion, and a fear of being taken in. And sometimes it can be a more or less refined expression of basic negativity and anger. People are often unaware of this. It can be interesting to examine more closely the things that one finds oneself laughing at. There is also a certain style of humour that goes with one's nationality. One needs to be aware that what one thinks is funny may simply be unintelligible to people from another culture. But humour can be a good thing. Freud speaks of wit in terms of energy release. Sometimes, if you really let yourself go, notwithstanding the Buddha's dim view of extravagant laughter, innocent merriment can have an energising and freeing effect. At its most innocent, humour is to do with not taking oneself too seriously. It is easy to fall into an attitude of regarding some trivial aspect of one's own life or work as being of world-shattering importance. It is important to cultivate a sense of proportion with regard to oneself and one's own achievements and affairs. You need be no less serious or hard-working, but you won't be taking yourself seriously in that self-absorbed, egoistic way. This idea of spiritual life as a playful bubbling up of transcendental energy is a prominent feature in Indian thought and religious life. Some people take religion very seriously, even to the extent of feeling that it is somehow blasphemous to laugh in church. But the Bodhisattva's life isn't like that. It's a game, a play, a sport. That is, it is an end in itself, uncalculating, natural, and enjoyable. Virya is clearly the more active, assertive, creative of this pair of paramitas, while Kshanti is the more passive, receptive, and quiescent. Between them, they represent a definite polarity in the spiritual life, and two radically different approaches to spiritual practice. One stressing self-help, do-it-yourself, self-exertion, while the other emphasizes dependence upon a power outside oneself, reliance in some cases on divine grace. The first is the attitude of getting up and doing things oneself, while the other involves sitting back and letting things happen. In India, they have a rather charming way of referring to these two approaches. One, they say, is the monkey attitude, the other is the kitten attitude. When the baby monkey is born, it clings onto its mother's fur with a very tight grip. Admittedly, the mother is carrying the baby, but the baby monkey still has to hold on with its own strength. The kitten, by contrast, is completely helpless. Its mother has to pick it up by the scruff of the neck and carry it. In the Indian traditions, the monkey type of approach is associated with jnana, or wisdom. The wise person is self-reliant and self-motivated. But the attitude of the kitten is associated with bhakti, the path of devotion, a feeling of dependence upon some divine power or ideal superior to oneself. These two approaches are generally held to be contradictory, even mutually exclusive. Either you depend on your own efforts or you depend upon another power. And Buddhism is usually held to be a religion of self-help rather than self-surrender. But neither of these statements is strictly true. In Japanese Buddhism, the two approaches are represented respectively by Zen Buddhism and Shin Buddhism. Zen stressing reliance on jiriki, self-power, while Shin, the Jodo Shin Shu especially, stresses reliance on tariki, other power. The other power in this case being the spiritual power of the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. The Buddhist texts make a number of references to the helpful spiritual influences that emanate from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. These influences are sometimes called grace waves, and they are said to come vibrating down from the higher spiritual regions, from Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and to be felt by those who are receptive to them. There is a parallel conception to this in Christianity, the grace of God, but it cannot be said to be equivalent, as Buddhism has no conception of a supreme being. These grace waves arise essentially within oneself, just not within the self we usually experience. They arise from depths, or descend from heights, if you prefer, of which one is not usually conscious, but to which one's awareness can be extended, and which can, in a sense, be included within one's greatly enlarged self. The point to be grasped here is that the word bodhisattva refers not to an abstract concept, but to a spiritual reality. In other words, bodhisattvas do exist on some other level from the one we normally inhabit and experience. But what is the connection between these two worlds? What is the connection between ourselves and the bodhisattvas? After all, a bodhisattva, by definition, would want to have some sort of connection with us. Perhaps one could say that there is a sort of mutual tuning in. When you become aware of a bodhisattva, not in an abstract, conceptual sense, but with your whole being, when you tune in to a bodhisattva, you are in contact with them, even if it is in a very subtle, attenuated, distant way. Something passes from them to you, just as something passes to you from anybody with whom you are in contact, physically, emotionally, or on whatever level. What passes from a bodhisattva to you is what we have already referred to, translating the Tibetan expression as grace waves, also sometimes translated as blessing. The equivalent Sanskrit word is Adisthana. Perhaps one shouldn't think of grace waves as anything special. They simply represent the possibility of communication. Just as when you communicate with another person on your own level, the two of you subtly affect each other. In the same way, the fact that you are aware of a bodhisattva and that they are aware of you means that you are subtly influenced or affected by them. That sort of influence is what we call grace waves. But there is another aspect to the Buddhist conception of grace waves that does find a parallel of a kind in at least some forms of Christianity, in which the idea of grace seems to represent something almost arbitrary. For instance, in Calvinism, there is the concept that some people have been predestined to eternal life, not on account of anything they have done, but through the grace of God, which seems to have some of the characteristics of the arbitrary will, the pure whim of some absolute monarch. One gets the impression of something undeserved. This conception of grace has some merit, in that in a sense we don't deserve anything, not because we are miserable sinners, such a doctrine has no place in Buddhism, but because there is nothing one can do in a mundane sense to deserve the transcendental, just as one can't arrive at wisdom by accumulating any amount of merit. Whether one adopts the self-power or the other-power approach doesn't matter. In either case, one is confronted by the basic distinction between self and other, subject and object. One's aim is to transcend the distinction between subject and object. So the means adopted must also transcend subject and object. When that starts to happen, progress, insight, really begins. Meanwhile, one has perforce to think in terms either of subject or of object, either of making the effort oneself, or of effort being made on one's behalf. In fact, though, it is impossible to separate the two. One may begin by adopting the approach of self-help, but it will soon become obvious that other power cannot be ignored. While if one adopts the attitude of other power, one cannot ignore self-help. If, say, in terms of Japanese Shin, one decides to rely entirely upon the vow of Amitabha, that will involve giving up reliance upon self-power. But in practice, it takes a lot of effort to give up one's own will and rely on somebody else's effort. So it turns out that self-power has to be part of one's approach. Likewise, the self-power of, say, Japanese Zen is never simply that. Take, for example, something as simple as walking along a road. True, you walk along it by your own effort, but did you build the road? You walk by the grace of the road. As well as by the grace of the law of gravity and the fact of the earth's existence. There are definite limits to self-power. Self-help, in other words, cannot exclude an objective element. One may make the effort to practice the Dharma, but suppose the Dharma didn't exist for one to practice. Other power involves self-power and vice versa. And whichever approach one takes, the aim is to arrive at a point where one is dependent neither on self nor on other, but has transcended that particular dichotomy. A bodhisattva combines both approaches, practicing both patience and vigour, because both are necessary. Sometimes in spiritual life, as in worldly life, it is necessary to hang on, even to hang on for grim death, to make an effort, to strive and struggle. At other times it is best to let go, let things look after themselves, even let them drift, let them just happen without interfering. However, one needs to know when to apply each approach. Broadly speaking, it is safe to assume that a lot of self-effort, or virya, will be necessary at the beginning. Then, once that initial effort has been made, one can begin to rely more upon a power that seems to come from somewhere outside oneself, or at least outside one's present conscious self. if one starts relying on other power prematurely, one may end up drifting away from the spiritual life altogether. The Indian mystic Sri Ramakrishna likened this to going out in a rowing boat. At first one has to make a lot of effort. It's quite a strain, especially if one is rowing against the stream. But when one finally manages to reach the middle of the river, one can hoist one's sail and the breeze will carry the boat along. In the same way, a great deal of effort is necessary in the early stages of the spiritual life, but a time comes when one makes contact with forces that in a sense are beyond oneself, though in another sense they are part of one's greater self, and these begin to carry one along. So there is a case for putting Virya before Kshanti in the list of paramitas. Not that the list should in any case be thought of as being fixed in any particular order. People have different temperaments. If one is predominantly of an impatient, restless, angry temperament, one may need to cultivate Kshanti first. Whereas if one tends to be rather sluggish or easygoing, then obviously Virya is what one needs to concentrate on. Either way, the successful outcome of these crucial initial stages of one's spiritual life will be finding a balance between Kshanti and Virya, a balance which is not static but dynamic, which perpetually adjusts itself to changing circumstances. Indeed, any spiritual quality is properly developed only as part of a rounded development. Develop understanding by all means, but develop sympathy as well. Develop sensitivity, develop tact, develop heroism, develop courage, develop everything. I have termed the dynamic and receptive aspects of the spiritual life masculine and feminine, and I have suggested that the use of these terms is more or less metaphorical. But it is not entirely metaphorical. There is a real correspondence between biological and psychological masculinity and femininity on the one hand, and spiritual masculinity and femininity on the other. What one must bear in mind is that the Bodhisattva combines both. This may seem strange, but the Bodhisattva can be described as being psychologically and spiritually bisexual, integrating the masculine and the feminine at every level of his or her psychological and spiritual experience. This is reflected in Buddhist iconography. With some representations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, it is hard to discern whether the figure is masculine or feminine. This iconographical convention reflects the psychological and spiritual bisexuality of the Bodhisattva, and indeed of any spiritually developed person. The idea, or even ideal, of psychological and spiritual bisexuality is unfamiliar to us in the West today, but it was known to the ancient Gnostics, one of the heretical sects of early Christianity. The teaching was quickly stamped out by the Church, but an interesting passage has been preserved in a work known as the Gospel of Thomas, which was discovered in Egypt as recently as 1945. It isn't an Orthodox Christian work, but it consists of 112 sayings attributed to Jesus after his resurrection. In the 23rd of these sayings, Jesus is represented as saying, "When you make the two one, and make the inside like the outside, and the outside like the inside, and the upper side like the underside, and in such a way that you make the man with the woman in a single one, in order that the man is not the man and the woman is not the woman, when you make eyes in place of an eye and a hand in place of a hand and a foot in place of a foot and an image in place of an image, then you will go into the kingdom." Note 147. This is not the sort of teaching one normally encounters in church, but it is obviously of profound significance. In the context of Buddhism, the idea or concept and even the practice of spiritual bisexuality features most graphically in the Tantra, where it is represented not just by the androgynous appearance of the Bodhisattva, but by the symbol of sexual union. Here, Kshanti, the feminine aspect of the spiritual life, becomes transcendental wisdom, while energy, the masculine aspect, becomes fully realized as compassion. Thus, in tantric Buddhist art, one encounters representations of a mythical form of the Buddha in sexual union with a figure who is sometimes described as the female counterpart to his own masculine form. These images are called yab-yum, yab meaning father and yum meaning mother. They are sometimes regarded in the West as being obscene or even blasphemous, but in Tibet such symbolism is regarded as extremely sacred. It has nothing to do with sexuality in the ordinary sense. It is a representation of the highest consummation, the perfect balance of femininity and masculinity, wisdom and compassion. Although there are two figures, there are not two persons. There is only one person, one enlightened person, within whom are united reason and emotion, wisdom and compassion.